on the air. So, aloha.
All right, thank you. Aloha.
Okay. I'm expecting a call in, too, from Ray Catania. He's going to share some things going on this evening. So, Sherry, you have been spent the latter part of this past week, over at the Hawaii Legislature. Is that correct?
Actually, I've been doing a lot of stuff on the DHHL level.
So, is that happening in Honolulu or here?
It's on Oahu and Kapolei.
So that means Department of Hawaiian Homelands.
Correct.
And so that would be statewide initiatives, but I'm sure at some level here in Kauai also.
Yeah, it does affect all four counties. And just for myself, for the audience that's listening, I represent, I'm a board of director for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, representing the Association of Anahola.
Okay, yeah. And you live in Anahola.
I do live in Anahola, correct.
Okay, and just also for the audience listening, when we're talking about energy and the biomass facility, something that's really important to me when I go to meetings towards the end of whenever a plan is in place, oftentimes it feels like the 11th hour, if not the 11th hour and 55th minute, and then we learn that there's things that aren't pono, shall we say, for the Hawaiian community who are our hosts. This is Hawaii, and that we want to make sure that the choices that we're making, you know, with our land are things that will, you know, honor our history and our future. So that's another reason why I have you in here today, just because when we're doing biomass, it seems like, at least on the surface, a very good idea, but we want to look deeply and make sure that we've thought about all the different elements that are important. What big issues were you working with for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands in this past week?
Let me just clear it up just a little bit. When we go and represent ourselves in the community, we are not working, quote-unquote, with the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. We are an organization that represents beneficiaries who try to work in conjunction with to push initiatives forward regarding our rights as beneficiaries to the trust.
Can you tell me the name of the organization then again so I have it right in my own mind?
Okay, there's three associations for the island of Kauai. The newest is a new formed organization out on the west side. And it's called, I think it's West Kauai West Side or something to that degree. West Kauai.
Homestead Association.
West Kauai Homestead Association. And then, Teddy, if you can tell me who the president of the association is. That was at Castaneda or something.
Name is Tano Castaneda.
Yeah. And then there is the Waimea the Kekaha Association, also of Hawaiian Homelands. And then the one that I represent is the Anahola Hawaiian Homes Association. Yeah, so there it's a little bit of different, you know, in regards to the roles that we play. Yeah, we are beneficiaries, meaning that we're homesteaders mm-hmm. on the property, and as homesteaders on the property, the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act also entitles us to different type of benefits, whereby we can utilize the lands for specific revenue supports for the department as well as for our homestead community.
And so, like, I was really happy to see that the Public Land Development Corporation has uh-huh. largely been repealed and put to sleep.
Correct.
A lot of that land is in Anahola.
Yeah, yeah. And we're actually kind of a little bit afraid of what's happening because, you know, we are also blessed that PLDC was actually abolished, but as beneficiaries to approximately 208,000 acres of land, we're pretty with our eyes wide open as to what's the potential of possibly happening regarding our lands and being requested by the state and by specific entities who want to be utilizing our lands. You know, so we're asking for the department to basically follow the rules, which is preference to Native Hawaiian individuals or organizations represented by Native Hawaiians to have preference. So we're kind of sketchy and very scared.
Okay.
You know,
and I want to explore that. When When the energy folks are in here, mm-hmm. what I want to do first is understand from Eric Knudsen,
correct.
What is the biofuels, biomass plant idea? I want to hear from him, you know, all the strengths of the ideas. Obviously, he's going to believe pretty strongly in it because he's dedicated a whole lot of time and intention. And, you know, when I look
at the... Definitely, definitely so. I mean, please don't get us wrong. We are the partners with the Green Energy team.
Well,
so we are very much in support, and we've worked and crafted out this project. And you know, it was over a long period of time that we found a win-win solution between Green Energy coming and utilizing our properties. But in addition to that, what they are actually doing is helping us beneficiaries to create available lands, because all the lands that they're going to be using is totally infested with albizia.
So
they're going to be using that as part of their
biomass,
correct.
And so in the process of utilizing the albizias and the biomass, they're going to be clearing the land,
correct.
To be available for people.
Exactly, for agricultural, homesteading, farming use.
What about housing?
Housing is not available up in those areas because they're too close to the water tanks and stuff like that. So they're designated properties. I mean, all our inventoried lands, certain sectors, farming, certain is agriculture, pastoral, homesteading. So they're all identified lands. Those lands will not be used. You know, they can be ag lots and stuff like that, or, you know, pastoral lands. So
we're hearing a win-win coming together in
exactly.
terms of clearing the property. When he comes in here, we're going to hear first about what is the possibilities and the potential on the energy side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then after 5 o'clock, we'll probably be getting some calls in from people. I know that some people have some concerns.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to let the listener know, you know, from the beginning, that we will be allowing time to address anytime there's something is impacting as a new energy plant.
Yes.
There's going to be opportunities and changes. So then we have to really understand what those are and make sure that
all the dynamics and
all the dynamics
affects,
and we'll
yes.
see, you know, what works out best.
Okay.
And Eric's in here.
Sorry, I got a little late. The traffic in front of the police station has been bogging up a lot lately. But your caller you're expecting is ready and on hold, so put him on the air.
Yep. Aloha, you're on the... Oops.
What? They were just there. Caller, can you please call back, and we'll put you right on the air. Sorry about
okay,
that.
Okay, no problem. So we'll be hearing, I believe that's Ray, and he's got an announcement. There's lots of things that are going on to be helping the community. There's so much empowerment. It's almost amazing how many different elements are coming forward to really be engaged. And I think when we have a lot of changes, that many that we need to make some changes because of all the shifts in our environment.
Correct.
You are on the air.
Oh, hello. Felicia.
Yes.
Hi. Yeah, this is Raymond Catania. How are you and your guest?
Good, good.
Good, good. Yeah, I just wanted to make a short announcement. I'm not going to try to take too long. James Alalem and I are going to be showing some movies next week, Friday at 6:30 at the Kappa Library. The first one is Strong Voices, Passionate Hearts, and it's about the demonstration that was over at the mayor's office a couple months ago, and it features the on the PLDC, and it features the young people from I think from Kanikopono.
Yep, I was there.
Yeah, you were there, right? You were there, and so, but it's not going to be any comment on that. It's just going to be straight. You know, the DVD is going to speak for itself. The young folks will be speaking for themselves and whoever was there. And so that's going to be shown. And then another one is No Heva. That's going to be shown. It's about the desecration of sacred lands by the military and corporations like Walmart throughout Hawaii and the resistance against it. And we're also going to have a photo display of how the bike path has destroyed much of the beach near the road at Wailua Beach. So we're going to have that. A photo display that James and I put together and other people, and it's going to be shown next week, Friday at 6:30 to 9:30 at the Kapaa Public Library. It's free. If anybody wants to find out more about it, they can call me at 634-2737 or James Halalem at 635-0835.
So you said 634-6737?
634-2737. That's my cell phone that I'm using now.
Okay.
634-2737. And James's phone number is 635-0835. And we're part of a group of people that take care and maintain heiau in the Wailua area. And we want to share this information with people. And it'll be an enjoyable evening. We'll learn from each other. So thank you for giving me the time.
Raymond, don't go off the air. I wanted to talk to you also, just to give you a little heads up of who I am.
Okay.
I am actually the one that also spoke in opposition. My family was actually the stewards of Haola and Hikinakala.
At Wailua.
In Wailua, correct. Our families were all...
Sherry.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah, I've heard of you, Sherry.
Yeah, so if off the air, or maybe you can reach Felicia and she can give you my contact information, and myself and Ted Blake would, you know, love to kuka with you and see how we can, you know, help further the awareness
of
everything that's been happening.
I think I got Brother Terry's phone number. I talked to him before in the past.
Yeah. Okay.
But I haven't talked to you, but I guess I can contact Terry and then he can give me your contact number.
Yeah, okay? Thank you.
Hey, okay. Mahalo. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Right on. So, yeah, you were at the Wailua bike path discussion right there where it is crossing over the heiau.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing that I want to just be able to look at all these issues energy-wise, everything that we can ahead of time, so that, like, if there are ways that we can accommodate or show respect for the past. You know, it's not always easy when we're living right on top of places that everybody else lived on top of. But so, you know, I really appreciate your mana'o on that.
And I was, you know, like I didn't mean to interrupt, like I was mentioning when I was asked by Ted Blake to attend the council meeting for the multimodal path. And the awareness to me was so evident that we are trying to push an initiative to have actually an inclusion of Native Hawaiian individual or an organization rep to sit and be present at the beginning processes of all projects relating to county, because I think it's so important that Native Hawaiians have a role in, it's not only environmental, it's not only business, it's not only visitor industry that gets to sit on this elite ad hoc committee and make all the decisions for us. Because whenever you're dealing about federal funding, you are always going to end up eventually meeting up with Native Hawaiians. And, you know, Section 106 allows the process to happen, you know, regarding getting our mana'o. But the thing about it is that we're trying to hit home, both he and I, is to say that, you know, there is that process that we are to be reckoned with, but we don't want to be behind the eight ball. We don't want to be in the back of the ball game. We want to be sitting up front and dialoguing, and we are not the speed bumps in the road. We can make it very, you know,
smooth
for you, you know, or if you keep us behind, then that's where all the pilikia happens. So we are demanding to be right up there with the rest of the constituents.
And not meaning to sound glib, but something I've always felt is what's good for the Hawaiians is good for everybody.
Correct.
Because the more that we honor our host culture, that was the group that was able to live resiliently on the land. That was the group that had this history of understanding how to maintain the environment in a way that was very life-affirming for human beings.
Correct.
And I know that there's some plants and animals that didn't make it through that time period, but in the balance, when you look at the world, island people are about the most effective conservationists. And so there's many, many good reasons to want to be able to be honoring the past. And so it's very important.
I'd just like to share a couple things that expand on a couple things that Sherry was talking about. It's not a point of trying to be overly assertive or mm-hmm. injecting one ethnic group's point of view. For years, I've felt a little bit hila about
shy about putting
forth Hawaiian initiatives. In 78, when we had the Constitutional Convention and we had five amendments, the Constitution would be written in Hawaiian, creation of Office of Hawaiian Affairs, trails, all traditional trails for sustenance and religion would be open, no adverse possession for more than one parcel at a time, and it'll be for 20 years and no grandfathered. Prior to that was seven years, and you could adverse possess as many pieces of properties as you desired. And all
what
of this,
is adverse possession mean?
Adverse possession means if, like, for in Hawaii, you had land that was maybe surrounded by the sugar fields. That land belonged to, say, Sherry's family. And for generations, it belonged to their family. And, you know, now instead of having one owner, you have 20 owners. And the land may be only 2 acres. So the guy on the street would say, why should I have to pay the land taxes if I'm not going to enjoy anything? Because I can't cut it into 20 parcels. So what the sugar companies would do, they would plant sugar there, occupy it for 7 years.
And like quiet title it?
Quiet title.
Okay, correct.
And they could do as many as they wanted to at one time. So this was 7 years, just 7 years, 7 years. After they paid the taxes 7 years, they just come to you and say, this is mine now. And many, many Hawaiian families lost their land and are still continuing to lose their land. Not as much, but in 78, the Constitutional Convention said you do it. You can do one parcel of land at a time. The clock starts today, 20 years, no grandfather. So when these amendments were passed by the Constitutional Convention, they had to get ratified by the 50 plus 1% of the voting public. I felt really like, how are we going to convince other people that they should treat the Hawaiian special? That's what I was feeling. When in reality, it wasn't special at all. It's that we are treated less fair than everybody else in Hawaii. And this is our home.
Yes.
This is our home. There's no respect and dignity given to the Hawaiians. And I don't want to belabor the pathway at Mahunapu'oni. One of the problems we have is that names are given to places that are modern names. You have tunnels. What is tunnels?
Makua.
But what is tunnels? You know, I mean, the name Makua has a special meaning. I gave a talk to the county administration while we're showing them the scenic byway that we just got a designation from the state. And I was talking about some surf spots right after Kuhio Park. And I mentioned the names, you know, Kalapa Ikab, Kalaikiki. And one of the head of the county department said, you know, I surf all the time. Where's these places? I said, you may know my different names. She said, like what? I said, PK's acid drop and heroines.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, you lose a sense of place and you lose the meaning of it. So when you talk about a bike path on Wailua Beach, I ask, where is Wailua Beach? Not to be a smart aleck, but where is Wailua Beach? In Wailua. Where in Wailua? In Wailua by Coco Palms. I said, there's no beach called Wailua Beach. Wailua is the name of the Ahupua. The beach is called Mahunapu'oni. Something's hidden in the sand dunes. If you knew the name, of course you would say, what does it mean? You know? The area is called Wailua Nui Ahuano. That's a ili aina, a section of that Ahupua. And that is translate to great sacred Wailua. And doing some research and some history and listening to the chants and kupuna, you'll find out that this was the birthplace of all our ali'i, and it's considered the most sacred of all ali'i places in Hawaii'i. So when we have a bike path going through there, you know, I went to see the administration as a private individual and as a native Hawaiian, and I say, why are you building a pathway through there? They said, listen, we have done every test known to man to ensure that we're not building the pathway on Ivy. I said, that's second base. Getting up to bat is why are you building it there? You know, I said, if you do something, if you do these tests to look for Ivy in Arlington Cemetery or Punch Bowl or even easier, Koloa Cemetery, you think the people would just sit down and let you build a bike path there? I said, you're destroying the sacredness of the place. You've seen depictions of Native American burials. You know, the movies, the Western movies always do that. Their Ivy is not in the ground. Their Ivy is up on stilts.
But it depends upon which tribe, but
right.
Yes.
So when the cavalry crosses into this area, what do the Native Americans do to them? They toast.
That's right.
So that is my question is, how can you not show us respect and dignity in our most sacred places? Number one. Number two, they come back and said, well, we built a road through there. You said, what about the road we built, you know, Kuhio Highway in the late 40s, early 50s? And my response to that is, could you smoke in restaurants 30 years ago? Can you smoke today? The awareness has come up to a different level, as is the Hawaiian culture and the Hawaiian history. So to me, it's a definite slap in the face, and we've been slapped in the face so often it becomes normal. So when we talk about putting Native Hawaiians, either an organization or individual, on every board and commission that we have, you eliminate a lot of this stuff that we've gone through, you know?
Well, I think that's important, and it also does actually matter which person. It's kind of like saying if you put a woman on every board, you know, we have a lot of differences between the women that might be on the board, but it's a step in the right direction.
Well, the response to Sherry when she put that forth was, how do we decide
which Hawaiian?
And the same way you decide which community person you're putting on.
Exactly.
Which person from the visitor industry. You have a public hearing after this to address
not be looked at any differently in regards to who is to represent our people. I think what we want to do, first of all, is to allow a seat to be open for us to actually kuka. You know, that is more important than who sits on the chair. And like how Teddy said, which is so true, and the question, you know, before the question came out, I was in the back with one of the council members who actually spoke to me, and I called it right before it actually happened. I said, that's what's going to be posed to you. How do you decide which person will represent the Native Hawaiian organization / individuals? And we should be looked at no different. Environmentalists, you have for the Planning Commission. You have two seats available for the environmentalists, which is awesome. Now, when you talk about the environmentalists, you have a wide spectrum. The people who are with natural resources, the people who are Save the Whales, the people who are whatever that they fight for. But there's a bunch of us out there.
Yes.
You know, so that's the way we wean it out. But, you know, we don't have like 100 of us knocking down the door said, I want to be the one. You know, we are creating awareness so that people come forward and step up to the plate.
And that's one of the great things about KKCR, and you are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. And, you know, what we try and do in having these public conversations is raise awareness and to be looking at what kind of directions that we need to be moving in these really critical issues. And so, like today, when we are focusing on energy, and I'm going to make sure and mic test my people, like, Eric, I need you closer. Say hello.
Aloha.
That's Eric Knutson, who's leading the biomass effort, and we have Jonathan.
Aloha. How are you doing today, Felicia?
That's Jonathan Jay, running for Board of Directors. And I also have Jack Benzie.
Aloha.
There, and so these guys have really diverse backgrounds, and so they're in here in the energy conversation. We're going to spend our first focus learning from Eric, what are all the strengths of the biomass plan? And I know that, Eric, you have a whole effort that you're doing with not even just biomass, but looking at, you know, the farming, many different things, your holistic resilience building effort there. So I wanna learn what we're looking at with the biomass facility. What's it called?
Green Energy.
Green Energy, is that what we're gonna call? That's the whole company. Is that the name of the biomass facility
too? It is.
Okay, so we're gonna talk about that for a while, and then we're gonna really give our energy board candidates a chance to be able to share their knowledge on what can strengthen that particular part. Last week, just for the listener, we spoke about solar power. In upcoming weeks, we're going to be talking about petroleum and hydro, but today's focus is this potential for biomass. So, Eric, can you tell us what you're planning to do, where you're doing it, and what efforts that you have in place to be in keeping with the Hawaiian way, closed loop cycle on Kauai? You know, what are we doing? What should we be excited about?
I think what we're probably all of us here are excited about is sustainability and the need to get back to a more sustainable Kauai as in the past, hundreds, thousand years ago, where we weren't dependent on the outside. Today, importing 80-85% of our food, we've got of our energy being produced, we have 90% fossil fuel based, 85% of that 90% is foreign fuel we're buying, so we're having others pull oil from the earth, transport it, load it, unload it here, burn it, which isn't the cleanest, and a lot of challenges because it certainly isn't sustainable. It's not something that is Kauai-based by Kauaians for Kauaians as in the past in a closed-loop cycle.
And I think a big change that has happened in the past 15, 20 years is it used to be from friendly nations like Alaska or Texas or Mexico as opposed to people who don't like us, where we are actually getting a lot of our oil is sourced from places that are less than enthusiastic to be shipping to our markets. That's something that I have learned from the fuel folks. We'll talk a little bit more about that with them. But so we don't have that same source as easily available as has been in the past. So we're looking at this new pathway.
We are. If we look at even on the job side, we know that a lot of jobs have been created by getting that oil from the outside, and those jobs aren't here on Kauai, they're elsewhere. Also pricing, we're dependent on the pricing of the product of their work outside of Kauai, and if you compare that benchmark it versus say the mainland, where they've got 3% of their fossil fuel being sourced outside the U.S., where we have 85% of our energy, which is 90% fossil fuel based, coming from the outside, we're greatly exposed. And cost-wise for our homes, our families, we're looking at the most expensive energy in the country. If we look at Kauai, we're one of the most expensive of the Hawaiian Islands, sometimes the most expensive. So we have a real burden on our families today because of this unsustainable means of production of energy.
So you're going to be... I'm kind of a novice at this, so forgive my beginner level questions. You're burning things, right? They're going to come in there and get burnt, and then it heats up water, and that turns turbines to make energy. Is that right?
Well, I can share how it works technically. I do want to just mention that the priority should actually, I believe, not just be renewable energy. In fact, the priority, I think, should be on the demand side where we're reducing our footprint so we don't use as much energy.
Amen to that, brother.
You know, that's where we need to get to. That's where, in fact, my own emphasis is on DSM, demand side management, where we can use things like motion detectors and some real low-cost, easy things both in homes and offices. But I won't go into that because I know the focus today is not that. It's renewable energy.
We're calling megawatts. That's always something that should be on the table, like energy that isn't even spent. So when we have point source energy, That's energy that hasn't been spent.
That's right.
We don't have the line loss. But in this case, you're going to be, I'm really asking, burning albizia trees, is that right?
Yeah, well, if we, let's go to the energy side, renewable energy side as a secondary focus, primary being the DSM demand side. But as we know, we're not going to be successful tonight, tomorrow, with radically reducing our demand. We have to be realistic. And we know over the next probably decade, 2 decades, maybe 3, over time we'll decrease the need for energy, hopefully. But in the meantime, we can't continue with this unsustainable fossil fuel importation and fuel being used and burnt here, diesel. So over the years, it started back in as the origins of green energy. This green energy biomass to energy project was way back in May of 2004 with Mayor Baptiste, who had great interest and really started sort of the curious notion of, hey, what can we do? I was asked, because I had spent 18 years overseas. I was an exchange student in Sweden, came home 11 years ago to my parents living in Anahola. I found that, well, if I benchmark these back in 2004 that Brian and a couple council members asked me to do in Sweden, what kind of technology is over there? And I found that, well, I thought burning, like, you know, in your fireplace was really dirty. I was like, hey, you know, I've got a grandmother who died of lung cancer and was holding my hand at the time at the last moments, and it was just tearing my heart apart.
I'm sorry.
And I really didn't want that to happen to any of us again. And it hurt. But after I looked into this, I found out that, whoa, you actually, with these, on the back end of these biomass production units overseas, Japan, Scandinavia, you've got these electrostatic precipitators, just like you have on the mainland in some cases, where they clean this up, and you don't have the issues that I thought were there with fireplaces.
You're talking about, like, particulates.
Particulate matter.
Sure, and pollution.
Pollution. And if you do a comparison, if you look at these biomass to energy production units, you do a direct comparison versus old diesel burning that we do right now in Port Allen. We have two main production units of electricity. One is our naphtha up in, is it Copiah?
Copiah.
You've got down south in Port Allen your diesel use. You have, with the biomass to energy best available control technologies being applied, you have a you've got a fifth of the NOx, the nitrous oxide, NOx, NO1 and NO2 effluent or air effluent. You've got a third of the sulfur and less particulate matter. So if you graphically review that, and this was done by KUC's Sierra Research Consultancy, and compared the two, you find that the air is a lot cleaner with the biomass energy. That moved me to accept it. A couple years later, 2005, 2006, several of us came forth with, hey, let's look at this closer. What can we do together? So we went across the island looking at, well, where do we have other problems like this albizia infestation, where if we look throughout our forest, it's becoming a monoculture. This invasive non-Kauai albizia tree is just completely taking over.
And I want to just make a comment on albizia. I understand that was brought to be a nitrogen fixer for the sugar fields, and so many things like how was introduced by the Polynesians, when they're utilized all the time and used up, they were kind of in control. And when we don't actually use these plants any longer for some direct reason, then they grow wild.
You're right. That's how you know, it was protected. The king protected it. It was used for certain applications. You know what they're used for. We know even from the journeying we've studied from our forefathers.
Ropes, canoes, and so
right.
on. So the albizia were brought here for a reason. They are certainly beautiful trees, but we have too many of them and they're taking over. So albizias are some of the items that would go into the biomass.
That's right. In fact, we're looking at across lands. We have today, the Green Energy Project has 22-year license on state lands. This is not DHHL lands, so it's perfectly clear. This is state lands, Kalepa, if you know, just south and north of Wailua.
Okay, and are those still considered crown lands, or it's kind of...
You'll have to correct me. This is a 6,000-acre parcel, which originally was DLNR, and they moved it to ADC.
ADC.
The Agricultural Development Corporation.
Okay, all right. Uh-huh.
Malka lands that are heavily infested with albizia, where we were asked on the arable part, that is where there's grade of less than 15 degree, where it was used by sugar in the old time, and the soil itself hasn't been renewed recently and needs to be helped out, so to say. But albizia is doing well, needs to be cleared. So that's one area for that we have a long-term lease on, 1,000 of those acres. There's actually, of all 4,000, where to go in and clear albizia where it's economically feasible. We also have private lands under license or lease as well, where we go in and we clear out albizia, and then we plant DLNR forestry-approved trees. Just also, I've seen some on the blogs, also some questions coming through as, hey, you know, what is this, the tree that would be planted in its place before you clear the lands? Well, on the state lands, our goal is to bring it to ag, diversified ag levels. You've got food production possibilities where you clear the albizia, you plant over a time frame with a harvest cycle of 4.5 years, and you harvest that that DLNR forestry approved trees, which are not albizia, by the way. On the state lands, for example, it would be a eucalyptus with a nitrogen giving tree in between every other row.
So those would be planted?
Yeah, those will be planted, and 4.5 years only of cycling, of harvest time. So it's actually, we're not allowed to call ourselves forestry. The state actually has directed us to call ourselves diversified ag because it's less than 7 years of a harvest time. So officially we have to call ourselves diversified ag. And then clear that out, we've got a bond placed on these lands where we've placed a bond so that at the end of that cycle, of that term, which is for the state lands 20 years, we will clear out even the stumps and prepare it so that you've got an ag ready state on those lands.
And so those are nitrogen fixing trees that might be able to somewhat bioremediate the land as well?
They have to, because you can't have good growth of biomass trees without having a nitrogen giving, they call legumes, in between. Both are chipped and brought to the plant site. And the plant site, by the way, is not there. The plant site is on Knutson Trust lands. There's two families on there's two different families of Knutsons here. One is in Koloa. The others are Ernie and Carol from Adelholt, my parents, two different groups. I know they're both from Norway originally. Same city, in fact.
So I had some stuff that was brought forward to me today. Are these eucalyptus? Can we make sure they're not GMO?
Eucalyptus? Oh, my. Oh, yeah. Let's not do a comparison versus...
No, I mean, but there is a GMO, a genetically modified eucalyptus now. And so there was concern that wouldn't be the type of trees that
yes,
we would...
No. We will not plant anything that's not DLNR forestry approved. And comparison versus, for example, our corn GMO, et cetera, that wouldn't be... And I don't know which of the variants of that are genetically manipulated of a eucalyptus you're referring to. So.
Yeah, I mean, I have it loaded on my computer here, and yeah. I can send that to you. I can pull it up in a minute and look at it. But I think that, you know, what I really like to be able to do, this is in some ways like a public forum when
Absolutely.
People are listening. And so when there are fears that are brought forward, like... Whose land, like in a minute, I'd like you to speak to, like there's possibly some land in Anahola. I know that a letter was sent out today about a 2,100 acre parcel, I believe, that, you know, would be utilized by green energy. So we want to learn a little bit more about that. And so I had some people being concerned that this is homestead land that is going to be preempted for people with Hawaiian background to having homes. That was a concern. Sometimes, you know, people just frame what they're concerned about, so if we can address them. And then the other one was genetically modified trees, just not wanting genetically modified life forms being, you know, propagated in Hawaii, that, like, to put it lightly, or God made it best, right? That's how many people feel, myself included. Maybe we don't need to do the genetically modified trees. So it sounds like you have no plans for the genetically modified trees.
We do not. And first I need to clarify with the Anahola lands. Those are not currently included in our plantations. We have under license, under lease. I'll talk about that in the current direct discussions we have with DHHL and also with the Anahola beneficiary representatives in just a moment. But before I get there, let me explain that is not included. Today, we've got over 2,000 acres, 1,000 of which is on the state Kalapa lands and over 1,000 private lands. And included in this long-term 22-year licenses and leases. So we have sufficient land. We're fully financed. We both have our equity and our debt in place. We're USDA, RUS. We have a commitment from them as well in financing. We have two EAs we've done proactively.
Environmental
assessments. Because it wasn't required back in 2006, 2007 when we did it, but we proactively wanted to for our own use because that's where we're coming from. We're interested in doing something environmentally sound. Fortunately, and that's probably why we were selected as well with KAC, because they knew we were coming from that realm. Mm-hmm. So we did our first environmental assessment was done with a HEPA, a Hawaiian EPA level, with the FONSI being provided, finding of no significant impact.
EPA is Environmental Protection Agency.
Yes, and it's so good to do this in advance, because then you've got solid, you've got a structured way to review your environmental footprint, what you're exposing the island to, our island to, and what you're benefiting. And in our case, when we did the second level of environmental assessment, we did an environmental review together with RUS. That's the USDA RUS that included NEPA level, national level, which is...
So can you say these acronyms? Because RUS...
Rural Utility Services.
Okay.
Because we're a co-op here, because we're the people that own our utility.
And NEPA?
And NEPA being the national EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, instead of the HEPA. So it's both... We've done both a Hawaiian EPA, which is our requirement here in Hawaii. But on a national level, if you're going to use federal funds, you need to move it to a NEPA level, which includes things like NRCS, with soil conservation, and some really important things as well.
NRCS.
Who knows what NRCS is?
National Rural Conservation System, maybe? I don't know.
Oh, God, I should know that immediately, but here I am on the radio and under stress and don't remember.
Okay, so...
But NRCS, the beauty is that what it does is it moved us to a finding of no significant impact, FONSI, as everyone calls it. But that all that means is that we didn't have an impact of significance. It was negative. But for the first time, when we did the biological assessment, those that are doing it found, and in one of them even shared with us, that it's the first time he had ever seen a net positive impact. And how can you get a net positive impact with an action like this? I mean, what is this? So I asked, well, what does that mean? You know, our goal, of course, was to get a certification that this was a finding of no significant impact. But he said, well, the biological assessment came up with a positive impact. That's because we're removing the albizia. We have the effects on the air, for example. Biologically, we've got on the lands themselves, like I mentioned, the removal of an invasive. We've got plantations during the cycle of the harvesting. And then at the conclusion of the license of 20, 22 years, we remove that and have it prepared for food production or whatever ag production you choose, whether it be the state or otherwise or privately.
So I'm assuming, but I'm asking, that soil erosion is something that's really being brought into consideration. You know, when just in my beginner's mind, if I think of trees being ripped up by the roots, like the soil erosion, all of that's being addressed, or there's a plan for...
It is so important for our water systems, for our streams. And we'd like to... We would hope that what we've brought forth in our plan, which is very detailed, including riparian buffers for our streams, waterways, that in conjunction with prepping this for, in the case of the Kalapa lands, for ag use, that to move it to that state, you've got to remove that invasive tree, and you've got to do it in a way when the stumps are removed, like you're saying, that don't allow that runoff into the streams of the mud, sludge, all of that, and you can really create a real negative impact otherwise. And so there's all kinds of buffers and distance to streams. And
like setbacks and stuff?
Setbacks. And it's very complicated, but it's worth the time and effort over these years to have done that, to have that plan and to execute it well.
And your program is really deeply integrated to Kauai Community College.
Yeah.
And so are you basically helping to raise up people that are conscious of all these changes for employment in this practice? Am I making an assumption there?
Well, I'd like to, especially in the areas of DSM, outside of renewable energy, but the demand side management, where we're learning about how to reduce our footprint. There, it's very active at the college. We're working on even our classrooms to reduce our usage with motion detectors, et cetera.
Is that something that turns the lights off when there's nobody in the room?
Exactly. Okay. And zone it so that if you're on the second level of our library, that in one area it might be on just where you're sitting, and that where there's no other students there, they're off, all the lights are off. So you don't even need that focus on renewable energy, but instead you can zone it so you've got a much smaller impact, much smaller usage. And then finally I can conclude with some interest we have with Anna Hola. Do you want me to go into that? Or
I just had a quick question.
Sure.
Real quick. I live along the Sleeping Giant Trail in Wailua, and I know in the 1920s and 30s they planted a bunch of albizia for just the kind of the beauty of the tree, and now they're just gigantic trees, and I mean they're huge. And this biomass facility wouldn't be targeting any of these albizia, right? I mean, they are invasive, and it looks like nothing is ever going to take them down by the size of, I mean, the tree trunk is like the size of the room that we're in. And, I mean, they're beautiful trees, but in a way, they kind of got to go. So this biomass facility isn't going to be targeting those trees, will they, or are they?
If they're concentrated and they're many acres, it could be seen as feasible. We know that it's actually not the best biomass target, mm-hmm. so... It's like a balsa wood. It's a lot of air in it. So your transportation is, it takes like double, triple the truck loads because it's not dense enough. That's why you move towards standard eucalyptus type variants. But we need to clear it out. And that's why we have an interest from Anna Hola, and we have a mutual interest in this, in moving towards removing that albizia where it's very concentrated, mm-hmm. where there is a dialogue right now. Yeah. About clear, because homesteading in the Malka lands is targeted in 20, 30 years. We know on the Mackay side it's targeted now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us on island have been waiting decades, generations. I know several that are like third generation, you know, still on the list, not getting a homestead. So how do we get there for even the Malka lands that are way out there, 20, 30 years long-term general plan?
So to help the listener, Malka means up near the mountain, where Mackay means more forward. Are you meaning more towards the ocean or still Malka,
towards
the highway?
Mountains. So if we look at the highway and we go towards the ocean, that's our ocean areas that are targeted for earlier homesteading. And in the short term, 5-10 years, I hope. We all hope.
And can any of this rent going to you all, just because I know that there's a number of concerned people, and you haven't even rented the or leased the land.
We do not have it included today.
You don't have a lease. And I know that there is a public hearing, I believe, on March 8th that's in Anna Hola. For people who have concerns about
There's a beneficiary consultation on March 8th. The public event, I believe, is targeted for the 12th and the 13th, the evening of the 12th and the morning of the 13th, I think. I'm kind of premature here. But I know that it's coming up, and there's be public information being distributed about that soon. The interest is this, that on the Malka lands, albizia in hundreds of these acres, and the road system is like where the streams are now because they haven't been maintained, the ditches haven't been maintained. So you've got, if you go and walk the Anna Hola lands like I have, what you'll find is you've got water systems where the roads were in the cane days, and the first thing you need to do is do infrastructure improvements on these mountains, towards the mountain lands, and bring up the ditches to a level where the water flow goes back into the ditches and gets off the roads, and you push back the albizia so it dries up the road systems, and then you work the road systems to get up to par so you can travel on them. So you've got an ability to bring your vehicles in there for transportation of that invasive albizia off the lands. That in itself takes a lot of time and a lot of money, and it costs a lot for the homesteading group that is represented by DHHL and the Hawaiian
Homeland.
But
it's not, Eric, I just want to say, it's not only the homesteading group, it's the wait listers that are actually affected. You know, we as the homesteaders came with the green energy team to try and make it. So what we're actually hoping for, and what most people don't realize, is what we're fighting for is for all the wait listers that are actually on the wait list. Because it doesn't affect, what it's doing is the Department of Hawaiian Homelands did not put a penny into this project. They put absolutely zero money on the table. It was our direct negotiations with the green energy team who is putting all the money forward to create opportunities so that in the future these lands will be made available for the waitlisters, because as it presently is going, there is not enough of the administration's lead to create homesteading lands available for our people. So it's the few individuals and organizations that has the capacity to deal directly with organizations, cooperatives, to do what the department belongs doing for us.
So again, my novice level of questioning here.
Correct.
When you enter into a lease, like that land currently is leased to someone, right? It's like
absolutely
lease,
nobody. Those are inventoried lands that is within the department.
Okay, and so when that gets leased, then does that money then go towards helping people on the list get land?
I take myself back a step, and I would like to say that actually the CDC, HCDC has...
CDC, has the,
yeah.
Community Development Corporation.
Correct.
Hawaii Community Development Corporation.
Yes. We have the RPs to those lands. So what we're doing is we're trying to create opportunities to put our people on the land in both ways. We are partnering with them, and we can talk about the benefit agreement packages that we'll talk about later as we go forward into the whole concept of green energy and the department. And we can talk about later of how it'll affect us as a community. And in the future, it will affect the people that are on the wait list. So we have all these lands that we are actually, you know, trying to find partners with to create opportunities for jobs as well as education, because there's a lot of education. We're trying to infuse that into the younger generation who will be beneficiaries to these lands.
And is there, I know like with the solar system that was going up there, there was a preference given to Anohola folks first to work that job. And so it's the agreement hasn't even been made, but is preference given? I mean, that's a possibility, right? That there can be preferences for people in a given area?
What we can't do federally to not breach any laws is we can't say, oh, we're going to hire only Anoholans.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, what we can do, and is legal, is that we're, in our discussions, we're committing to put to a recruitment cell right there in Anahola so that it's easy, accessible to our people of Anahola to recruit to these jobs that otherwise today are off-island producing this oil, pulling the oil out of the ground and shipping it here. So we're insourcing jobs, and we want to do it in Anahola, primarily our recruitment, because that's where the jobs are.
For the Anahola land. I want to shift for a moment to talk about the facility itself. That is going to be
17.2 miles south. It's not related whatsoever.
Right. So that's kind of north of... of Kaloa, I kind of think near where...
Yeah, it's a Kingston Gap right there. You know where, before you turn on Malahia Road, you're going south before you take a left on Malahia Road, that's known as Tree Tunnel Road.
Mm-hmm.
A quarter mile north of that, on the right-hand side, 6 miles inland. Okay, so it's Malka. It's on the mountainous side
I'm
of the highway.
I'm thinking Kahili Mountain Park, like the little school that's up there.
Yeah, just north of there.
Okay.
North of there, that's where it is.
And so what are you displacing that was there? Is that like...
Albizia. we bought a 64.2 acre parcel from the Knudsen Trust in 2007 for the plant site.
We is who?
Green Energy Team LLC.
Okay.
And what we did is we bought back in 2007 with a single target of building this biomass energy plant in a place that KUC thought was most appropriate. Of the three locations identified, it was most appropriate for their grid because they've got sort of a weakness in their grid right there. They need that production there. It fits well. If you look at the air flows too going towards the mountains, and if you look at where you don't have a lot of houses, you know, it's in between sort of Lihue and Poipu in that area, very rural, and 6 miles inland. And you can't see it from the highway.
6 miles inland from the road or
from
the ocean. Okay. And then I tried in doing due diligence for this show to find a drawing of it on the internet. I didn't find it. Is it there?
If you go to greenenergyhawaii.com,
Okay, there that would be where I'd find
yes.
it.
Yeah, there's a like a PDF series there, which is really informative too. I think what was it? Mark Ventura Associates is the architectural team. Yeah, it's there.
So you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, the station that loves you. I like to say that. And we are having an energy discussion. We have Eric Knudsen from Green Energy with the biomass program. We have Teddy Blake, Sherry Cummings in here. I'm Felicia. Eric Cannon is here. And then also I want to bring in my other two guests pretty strongly. I have Jack Benzie and Jonathan Jay, who are both running for KIUC Board of Directors. And I want to start with Jack. A little bit, whatever way you can feed into this discussion, and I would also like you to be able to tell the listeners a little bit about your background, and then, you know, how we'll start to talk about how KIUC as a consumer would be interfacing with green energy.
Okay, thanks, Felicia. I guess I'll start with my background because that's easiest for me to remember. I've been on the island for a little over 7 years now. I moved here from San Diego area. I came here for a job. I was the technical director of the Pacific Missile Range facility up until the end of December of this year when I retired. And so I have a lot of free time that I didn't have when I worked for the Navy. I have a bachelor's degree in nuclear engineering and a master's degree in business administration, and I think both of those would help me bring some expertise to KIUC, both from the business perspective to help lower our rates, as well as from the engineering perspective to more efficiently produce the energy that we're doing.
Have you worked with hybrid grids? I mean, when you were doing as technical director, I'm not sure what all that would include on the base, but I think that that will be something that the board is going to be needing to do a lot more in the future, is these hybrid grids and finding that balance.
Correct. In fact, one of the things that they're pursuing over on the base is and it's more in the research and development area, but a grid that will be transportable to the Navy's looking at 20 years from now having an all-electric ship out there as part of the Navy to stop burning as much fossil fuel to drive their ships around. And this grid on the electric ship has to be able to supply all the household loads on the ship, but at the same time do peak loads for if you're firing a high-energy weapon or something like that. So we worked in that kind of area a lot. The base is on track to, by 2015, have the hotel loads, which are basically the houses and the buildings and that kind of stuff, fully supported by renewable energy. We have both PV, as well as we're working with but I'm not there anymore. They're working with the county for landfill gas off the landfill in Kekaha. So there is I do have some background in that, but not a lot of hands-on type experience. I applaud what Green Energy is doing. I think the solution for Kauai, it needs to be something that's Kauai-based, that's Kauai-sustainable, as well as something that can help us lower our rates. And I think biomass is one part of a much broader solution. I mean, we've talked about solar in the past. There's hydro. There's lots of different mechanisms to get renewable, Kauai-based energy sources. They all have some issues that somebody doesn't like about them. And I think the key is to do them right, take all the steps up front, and make sure we're doing all the things that need to be done to protect the land, to make sure it is sustainable, to make sure that we can use that in the future. And I think Green Energy is doing a good job of doing that, but they're just, I think when they're online, if my recollection is right, they'll give us about 10% of what our average power needs on the island are. So there's still another 90% there that needs to be taken care of. I think 10 of that is already taken care of with other renewable projects, but that still leaves 80% that is available for other projects that are renewable, that are Kauai-based, and that are sustainable for the population here.
So when is it going to come online, Eric? When will the biomass, I know it's probably
summer of 2014.
Really?
Yep.
Does that mean you have the building built?
Right now, we started our construction, And we're right now moving through. We've got both our grading and grubbing permit, and we're moving right through to in the springtime. In fact, I've got with me a schedule of the construction phases. There's only five of them, and I can share them right now just so everyone knows what the schedule is. Here it is. I'm bringing it up. If we look at it, the different phases, they're split up in these different sections. We have April 2013. We had our ground blessing, by the way. Look at the website, greenenergyhawaii.com. That was beautiful. And in January. And April, we've got what we call our start of our steel erection, April 2013. June 2013, the steel erection is complete. And January 2014, equipment installation complete. Spring of 2014, construction complete. And then finally, the summer of 2014, plant is in operation.
Okay. All right. Well, that's I learned a lot right there. Jonathan, do you want to share a little bit of your background and your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm actually more interested to talk about the Green Energy Project. And one of the things that's so exciting to me about it is that it's starting from where we are today and working from where we are right now. In a holistic fashion, which is pretty exciting to me because you don't often see projects conducted with that kind of thoughtfulness. For example, you know, we've got this Albizia infestation on the island, so it's addressing a problem right away, which is pretty cool. And the other thing that I think is really interesting about it is that it's a renewable energy source, but it deals with the base load. So unlike solar or wind, which are intermittent stuff, these turbines can be burning 24/7, and that's pretty exciting to me because that's one of the big problems with renewable energy, generally speaking, is that it's intermittent, and so then you still have to deal with your base load. So this is something that again is attacking directly what our needs are, which is it's exciting to see. And consistent with that is the focus on jobs. You know, there's going to be approximately 200 jobs created just with the construction of the plant over the next year and a half or so. But more interesting to me than that is the 39 or 40 or so jobs that are going to be part of the operational running of the project. And I'm imagining that's dudes with chainsaws climbing in trees and taking Albizia apart. So that's a pretty cool thing because there's an existing workforce here who would love to tear into that. So those are jobs not just that are going to be on Kauai, but for people who live here and grew up here and born and raised here. And so that's exciting to me in comparison to, say, like a solar project, because once the solar project is built, essentially, I mean, this is a simplification, but you just need one guy with some Windex and a squeegee to keep the solar panels clean. So that doesn't really make a lot of jobs on the island. Finally, there's the cost issue. And it's extremely competitive, more competitive than burning fossil fuels. So it provided some of the land issue questions and concerns and cultural concerns can be dealt with. And it seems like we're on a good track for that. I think this is a project people can be pretty enthusiastic about.
Okay. And I do want to also mention that there is a bill out for the solar financing too. We had a caller last week, and so last week we talked about solar power, and the goal was that within 5 years that maybe 50% of the daytime consumption could actually be produced by solar. So, you know, that seems like a great compliment. It's a really aggressive growth, and we had a caller last time asking, you know, how do people of more limited means be able to fund that, and
when they can't afford to put their money up front into a project mm-hmm. that's going to put, you know, $15,000-$40,000 on their roof.
Have you noticed the number of that bill? I think it's like 178.
It's Senate Bill 1087.
Okay.
And House Bill 856.
Okay, I was wrong. Yeah. Okay, there's one in each place. So that's another element that can really help our system. Okay, we do have a caller, and we'll go ahead and take that. You're on the air.
Hi, aloha. I live in Anohola, and my son is 50% Hawaiian. He's a Anohola beneficiary, and I just feel that there are so many Hawaiians that are on the waiting list, like approximately 40,000, and to give 2,143 acres of Anahola Department of Hawaiian Homelands for bio energy is wrong. I think that the Hawaiians should be put on the land, not GMO eucalyptus.
We were just talking about some of these concerns, and so I'll let them answer a little bit just so you can hear it from them. But we, what we were learning is that these lands that are being reutilized are much higher than the homelands where they would be bringing the houses in, and that part of the exchange is the clearing and the opening of roads for development lower down, and that there is no GMO in the eucalyptus. Do I have that right, both Sherry and Eric?
Yeah, I don't know where your family lives, but I actually live four houses down from the water tank. And directly in the back of my home, Department of Hawaiian Homelands gave, many years ago, they awarded leases. And some years after they awarded the lease, they ended up taking back those leases and awarding them different locations because they said that the water was not able to suffice for those lots that were going to be built in the back of my family's property. So these lands are even further up, and these lands were like ag lots. And so we all know that the department is... There is zero funding by the state of Hawaii. We are the only state agency that isn't given a penny amongst all the other state agencies that represent the state of Hawaii. And we are actually fighting because of the fact that what the department is doing is they are negotiating directly to income generate, to substantiate the operating costs of the department, as well as trying to raise funds to support making lands available. And they're not doing it quick enough. The biggest reason for revenue is to support the administration and the cost to operate. So our people are not even aware of the $0 that the state is giving us. So the priority is not to make lands available for our beneficiaries and our waitlisters. They are there to substantiate the revenues coming in to support the top-heavy administration. So what we are doing is we are actually creating opportunities to put people on the land. So that's a, you know, a misperception out there as to what's really going on. And these lands are like for ag purposes.
Does she have the number right? Is it 2,100 acres that is?
It is 2,100 acres, correct. Yeah.
And of that, if we look at the arable portion, and arable just meaning the usable portion that isn't in greater than 15, 18 degree grade, that's not too steep, it's about 1,100 acres in total. And the cane land was represents about that in the old time. It was about 1,100 acres. But of that, in this proposal that's being reviewed, I know, with Anahola, is that you'd have not the same mutual goal of moving it, removing the albizia and all trees, even after the plantation time of tree plantations, but removing all the trees and stumps so you'd have this diversified ag lots available, farm lots available.
Right.
You also would have your roads and your ditches under control, which is very expensive, millions of dollars of investment to bring up the infrastructure. So our mutual goal here is to get homesteads up on the, even on this these mountainous areas, the Mauka lands, in time.
And creating all the infrastructure necessary to open up those lands, because right now we all know that those back areas is just highly not traversed. I mean, you go and you look at the way it's so dilapidated, you know, you have a green energy firm that's coming in and they're putting the money where the mouth is, which is what the administration belongs doing, and nobody is doing that for us.
And, caller, let me know if I am interpreting correctly. You know, these are, you know, tied together issues. Okay. Now,
May I speak?
Yes, please.
Sure.
Well, Sherry, your parents got your Hawaiian Homelands awardee, and you're taken care of, and your kids are taken care of. I'd like my son and the 40 thousand other Hawaiians to be taken care for, cared of. If cane land was, if cane was grown there before, we can grow Hawaiians. You get this thing called Kanaka ingenuity. I understand that with this proposal, there's going to be displaced taro patch Hawaiians that are already growing kalo. Why can't we grow Hawaiians and give the Hawaiians some land, some aina? I understand the whole infrastructure problem. I understand what you said, that the bloated administration of DHHL, that's where the money's going to. So we could clean that up. But that is a different issue than giving for 30 years to Green Energy Team LLC. I think the Hawaiians should be put on the land, not albizia. I mean, not, excuse me, not eucalyptus. Okay, it's not GMO, fine. We're still talking about the issue. Putting the Hawaiians on the land versus eucalyptus, which is a non-native species, to burn at the expense of the native Hawaiians. Native Hawaiians make up 40% of the prison population. Most native Hawaiians are dead before 55. I say give the Hawaiians a chance. Put the Hawaiians on the land, not eucalyptus.
Okay, thank you so much. She's bringing forward really important. Do you have a comment?
No, I just wanted to say that it's a noble gesture to put the Hawaiians back on the land, but you know, I mean, you need the education, you need the means.
Are you saying that Hawaiians are uneducated and
they don't have the ingenuity to do it?
DHHL was created in 1960.
Let me finish, please. You've got somebody that's cleaning, taking all of this out. I'm not saying Hawaiians are uneducated. All I'm saying is you got to give them the education to do the type of job that they're looking to do, because they'll be much more productive.
I think the Hawaiians could do it. They get muscle. They're strong. They're smart. And okay, we could get some kind of...
Thank you. I appreciate you, Manau.
Okay. She's raising a really strong point, and we will hold that going forward with great respect. I'm going to take the next caller, but like...
Mahalo.
Okay. Mahalo.
Aloha aina.
Yes. Thank you.
Put Hawaiian home. Put Hawaiian lands in Hawaiian hands.
Yes. Thank you. Aloha.
Mahalo. Ke kua.
So there is a real big challenge with land for the Hawaiians, and I don't think that we can understate that in any way, but I'm understanding right now that this land that's coming up, people could come and talk at this meeting, they can look at it. It seems like there's probably other places, too, that can be harvested, so we'll be... That's moving forward, right? So I want to respect that people are frustrated that they've been on this list for generations.
Okay, I totally agree. And with that being said, we feel the same frustration. And that's why when we have people that have the capacity to do what the department belongs doing, you know, and then they get shot down for trying, you know, the frustration, you know, we're just as frustrated as them. We're trying to create opportunities so that it happens. We're trying to expedite the process. If we didn't do it, those lands would lay fallow forevermore. 20 years ago, it was my brother who went to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, who knew that those lands were going to be inventoried back into the department. And he came up with this ingenious idea of doing stuff up there to create opportunities for waitlisters to utilize the property. The department turns around, laughed at him, and tell him they can do them themselves. Fast forward 20 years later, what happened? All of these albizias, they just went chaotic. Now to the caller, seriously, that said that they want to be put back on the land, with all that albizia up there, how much can you do? Even the cows that are all up there. You know, it's like, that's all you can have in there.
Well, I think that what we've seen with the Public Land Development Corporation, the Agribusiness Development Corporation, all these things, is we need to have a very, very strong, comprehensive conversation on how we're going to fund our state. And personally, when I look at how underfunded the Department of Hawaiian Homelands is, I say, well, that's only because they aren't given a priority. And so it's a question of priorities. When I hear it's broke, well, it's because somebody doesn't want to fund them. That's how it looks to me. We're putting airports, we're putting military bases, we're putting GMO fields in these places. I understand the frustration, and it's a question of priorities, my opinion here. I got more callers, and then we're going to come back, and I'm going to bring in our candidates a little bit stronger. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Felicia. I have to agree with the lady that just called in, and I think that what she's getting at is the fact that in order for these projects to be done on Hawaiian homelands, according to the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, certain obligations have to be fulfilled first as a priority, and that means to get the waitlisted people on land first. That's the priority. That hasn't been done. They've been really, really badly neglected.
I think there's no intention to do it, you know?
Yeah, okay. Another thing I want to ask these people that are proposing this eucalyptus green energy project, is this going to be done on lands that are classified in the Admissions Act as available lands? They're called available lands.
Available.
The Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, you have basically agricultural lands, pastoral lands, and homesteading lands.
Well, there's also a designation in there called available lands.
Okay.
And these are lands that pretty much with the intent of the Admissions Act would be available once the obligation of DHHL has been fulfilled, and that is to get these people that are waiting for decades to get on their land, let them clear it, for God's sake. They know how.
Well, you know, let me just say something. We are not the ones that are holding DHHL's hand. Trust me. We are the ones in the meeting that are fighting the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. We are the ones that are asking for federal oversight because of the neglect, the gross neglect,
okay,
that they have done to our people.
I'm stating all the great things you'll be for the waitlisted people, but I didn't hear anything about getting them on their list.
That's what we're trying to do, because the department is moving too slow for us. And if we don't do it, nobody's going to do it. And now it's really discouraging. If you actually following Senate Bill 168, they're screwing up with our monies. What they're trying to do is they're trying to take our monies and say, hey, Department of Hawaiian Homelands, your revenues, you go ahead and you go develop on state lands and on private lands. So we're telling them, what the hell? You belong developing on our lands. You belong putting the money on our lands, not on private developed lands, on private owners' property and on state lands. So we're over here asking them. We had 3 months ago, DOI, Department Secretary of Interior, Assistant Secretary of Interior, come and sit with us. And we're asking to come in and see the gross neglect of the governor and the state of Hawaii and what they are doing to our agency, because they are only mandated to take care of our trust lands, but they are not doing nowhere near what they belong doing. So we are just a little minor organization that is trying to do what they belong doing a long darn time ago and haven't done it all.
Okay, thank you. I've got calls waiting, and I appreciate your concern.
I am sorry.
Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks a lot. You know, I think the Albizi is a terrible problem, but I have kind of three questions or three thoughts. One is, how are they going to transport that Albizi around? You know, when they had sugarcane, they used to use the trucks on the roads and cross the roadway. So what are they going to have big log trucks bring trees down from Anahola to near Kahili Mountain Park? And then the Albizi is just kind of a junk wood. So I wonder, like a balsa wood or something, so does it have the heat value to harvest it and bring it all in, transport it, and come out ahead? And then the idea that you're going to plant eucalyptus and harvest them in 4.5 years, it doesn't seem practical. You know, nobody's doing that in Hawaii. And Bill Cowan actually got a lot of government money to plant albizias as nitrogen fixers and grow eucalyptus right out there by the plant. But that whole project has been overgrown by the albizias. So how are they going to do it on the roadways, and does the albizia have the heat value? And, okay, thanks a lot. I'll listen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great questions. I can address all three. This is Eric Knudsen. If we look at the first one on transportation, primarily we want to use the cane roads where accessible. And we also have a DOT, a Department of Approved DOT plan for transportation on the highway where necessary. And between 9 and 14 trucks a day. It's not practical to transport Albizia in the long term. It's not the best wood because it requires such volume. So that's where we have the eucalyptus as well as other types of trees, not Albizia as the nitrogen-giving tree on our plantations. The heat value on your second question is good. But the problem is that you have such volume that you need three times as much of it, two, three times as much of it as you do as the compact eucalyptus. So the heat value question, we've got it, several test burns, one at Hazen Research in Colorado and a couple of others that we've compared. They're all within range where it's actually okay, but you've got such volume that the transportation is not feasible over the long term. That's why we won't continue with Albizia on our lands transporting it. And thirdly, with the 4.5-year cycle, Bill Cowan has Albizia every other row, and his often Eucalyptus douglupta, that's a beautiful rainbow tree, which is overshadowed completely, you're right, by the Albizia. And that's not the program that we will have because you've got overshadowing. You don't have the growth rates you need over the long term. And he has other plans as well over the long term. But that is not our design, our conceptual design, when it comes to the plantations of using your Albizia as a nitrogen-giving legume.
Thank you. And so I want to pull it back to my KIUC candidates for a moment here. Jack, how do you feel like you will be able to really strengthen the plans for Kauai, you know, with their energy use? What strengths do you have and what vision do you have for the utility company?
Well, my vision for the company would be to continue. When I first got here 7 years ago, we were doing hardly any renewable energy at all. And over the last 7 years, we've made significant progress, and there's plans to continue that, and I would hope to continue that type of effort so that Kauai could be more sustainable. And I think the one thing I haven't seen is in the 7 years I've been here, my price per kilowatt hour for electricity has ranged from a low of 22 cents a kilowatt hour to a high of 52 cents a kilowatt hour. And it just jumps all over the place because we're so dependent on that oil. I would like to see us come up with a better business model where we can be sustainable locally and have lower rates that are more consistent so that people know what their electric bill is going to be and they can afford, they can budget for it, and they can pay it. And we don't have people struggling to pay their electric bill. And I think that my experience in you know, I have 36 years of experience working with the federal government in managing organizations that are the size of KIUC or larger. And I've had small business experience in California running a small business for over 10 years that was successful. So I have the background both on the business side and the engineering side, I think, to help the board make the kinds of policies that are needed to direct the utility so that the members benefit.
Okay, thank you so much. Jonathan?
Well, one of the things that I think that KIC could really benefit from is becoming a fundamentally more democratized organization. And by that, what I mean is that it's a co-op, it's a cooperative, and it's owned by the members, and the people who are using the electricity are the ones who are the owners of the co-op. But so often, we don't really see KIC yet as a member-driven organization. Right now, most of the policy and most of the plans, the long-term strategic thinking, all comes from inside the utility end of the co-op. And so what I'd like to see is that process be opened up. And the reason why is because there's a lot of amazingly smart people on this island. You know, Eric Knudsen is just one example. Hey, he's got this idea. Hey, what if we could build jobs, get rid of invasives, help the local economy, create baseload energy here. He's not inside KIUC. He's a voice from outside KIUC. And there are many, many, many other voices from outside KIUC that I think that if they were allowed to be heard, or if KIUC began listening more better, that the entire operation would benefit from. So that's one of the things I'd like to see. Also, Eric spoke about this earlier, is the demand side. You know, so many of our solutions that we're constantly looking for our energy problem are always supply side solutions. People can dream up, oh, we can have magical wind turbines. Oh, we can have magical solar panels. Oh, we can have magical hydro dams and stuff. Those are all good, but they're all supply side, and none of them deal with the fundamental problem, is that we have energy consumption problem. That's our real problem. Is not that we're not making enough energy in the world, is that we're using it too much and using it in ways that are really not very thoughtful. You know, like phantom load. Phantom load is when your plasma TV is running on standby all night long. Your TV is ready to turn on in a second if you were to get up and start watching it. But nobody ever does that, and so that's like 30% of your television's draw is just by being on standby. So, and another example is something as simple as the technology of clotheslines. I mean, that's not a very complicated technology. That's like a piece of a rope. But you can get your clothes 70-80% dry, even on an overcast day, and that's 70-80% savings on your electricity. That's electricity that you don't ever need to use in order to have a comfortable lifestyle. And so,
and then you throw it in the
yeah,
water,
if
the
you,
dryer.
If you need to punch it up for the last 10 minutes or so, that's a 10 minute cycle you ran instead of an hour. That's tremendous savings. And what that does is it reduces all of our energy consumption on the island, so that we don't even have to make all this extra power. You know, one of the ways that we can bring our green energy project up to higher than 11% is if we start using less power. You know, if we cut our power in half. All of a sudden, green energy will be providing 22% of our power base needs. So those are the kind of things that I think that we can really benefit from extremely as a community.
I think Jack had something to share on that.
Yeah, I just want to say that I agree with both Jonathan and Eric in that demand-side management is an important part of our utility and our electric use here. And I was just at the KIC board meeting this morning, and one of the things that was reported is our average usage here on Kauai is less than 500 kilowatt hours a month, whereas opposed to another island like Oahu, it's over 700 kilowatt hours per month, their average usage. So Kauai,
it's already doing,
although we're not
job.
Doing as good as we would like to do, we are doing better than a lot of other places, and I think the word is getting out, and people are starting to be aware of this stuff, and we need to continue that kind of thing.
Well, the trick for stuff like that is some of our successes are based on our failures, and that's because if the price of electricity is crazy sky high, people are going to start conserving, and that's not because KAC has done anything right. You know, I talked to some of the good people over at KAC, like Paul Daniels. He's an energy conservation expert. He does free energy home audits. Well, you know, He's a great guy. I talked to him for half an hour on the phone, and he was super helpful, super informative, had all kinds of really good positive energy, to make a little joke there. But he's also completely swamped. You know, I said, when can I get a home energy audit at my house? And he said, well, we're backed up 50 people, 50 homes in front of you, so it's going to take 5 or 6 months to get to you. And I said, well, gee, how many people are in your department? You know, how much of a priority organizationally has KIEC made demand side management at home at the residential level for our community? How much of a priority have they made that? And the answer is not a very great deal, because Paul Daniels is virtually alone in his department. So no shame on him, because one person can only do so much. But hey, if we have such a demand for this kind of energy savings, let's meet the community at least halfway and beef that department up. You know, here's another example. We had the big whole saga, I guess you'd call it, with smart meters last year.
Yes.
And that was a determination that was made inside the utility. That wasn't the community who came to KIEC and said, can we please have smart meters? You know, that was something that was, a decision was made in the inside and then passed down. But what people did ask for was the in-home display units. And those are the units that can show people, kind of like a dashboard on your car, how fast am I going? How much power am I using? How much does my refrigerator draw? You know, and you can actually begin to get information about what your power usage is like. Well, 500 people asked for those things, and then boom, they're all gone, because KIEC made a priority to get 26,000 smart meters, but only 500 in-home display units. So So that's a really, I think it's a really small example, but it shows how the priority towards savings it hasn't been elevated to an appropriate level inside KIUC.
I think that you made some really excellent suggestions, and then how do we incentivize people? How do we teach them to be using these different power savings? I mean, like, how do we get them excited about it? I think there's actually probably a number of ways where we can challenge people, almost by zip code or something, see how much we can bring it down.
Like a contest for different parts of the island, so you can conserve more?
You know what, to me, whenever I hear about these different facilities like the hydro or different pieces coming in, I think, you know, punish the power consumers, the people who aren't, you know, being conservative. Well, then they get to get their water taken and utilized. You know, I mean, why if there's an area that's doing a very good job, should they have to have their water be the hydro plant? You know, maybe we can incentivize people if they don't like a biomass plant, or they don't like a hydro plant, or they don't like something, well, use less. And then,
well, one of the things that I would like to see, and this is a little bit tricky because you want to make sure that you don't hurt working families, but I would like to see some kind of stepped rate of power cost, such that the first small amount of power that each household gets is at a lower rate, and then it steps up to a higher rate, so that if you have someone who is very comfortably well off and wants to have all their lights on and their water features pumping and they truly that's the lifestyle they want, and they can afford it, and they can afford to pay extra for that, well, then they should go right ahead and pay extra for that.
Well, what about the houses that there's 15 people living on a meter? Well, there are those.
That's a real world issue that we have to deal with here in Kauai, and it seems like some kind of per capita information about each household could be accommodated. I know that when I signed up for KIUC, they asked me, how many refrigerators do you have? Do you have an air conditioner? Do you have an electric or a gas dryer? They asked me all kinds of questions about the appliances that I use. They didn't say, how many people do you have living in your home? How many adults do you have living in your home? That's a very simple question to ask. And that way, on a per capita basis, you can have, you can apportion out affordable electricity for all. And then you can let the people who can afford to pay, who choose to pay, voluntarily want to pay more, let them.
Right. And there are ways that that's been done successfully in other places, both with not only electricity use, but water use, where you can take a period of time and just baseline the usage for each home for a baseline, and then you start charging people as they start
going over
that baseline. Yeah. Right.
And that's not even something that you need a smart meter for. You can do that with a plain old-fashioned dumb meter.
Exactly.
So we just had a caller, and she was asking, we had a caller. She was asking if all this trucking that we're going to be doing with all the Albizia, she was thinking, you know, obviously it's going to be large-scale trucks that are going to be doing this. She was wondering if it was really going to be an efficient process trucking all this the cut-up debris back and forth across the island, if that was really factored into the equation, considering all the greenhouse gases it was going to contribute to. That was the caller's question.
It's a good question, and we want to have our plantations as close as possible. And if we look at 25% of our feedstock, which is sourced from Bilkauran, and 75% from our own lands, the Anahola lands actually offer a closer location of plantations than we actually have under lease license, under option agreement. So that would reduce the transportation length. And I know that we're laughed at from the outside a lot. Our whole island's only 25 by 25 miles. And so they kind of laugh at, you know, your distance is going to be real short anyways. But yes, the caller's right. We want it right around the plant, and we've tried to do that, and we're fairly successful if you look at the majority of the lands.
Lisa, I got a question for Eric. I know your EA said there was
environmental assessment.
No findings of significance for the water that you use to cool the plant and put back into the rivers. Are you doing any type of testing over that to check the waters? And the reason I'm asking is, all this water comes from Kuia, and it waters the entire Kalo'aupua, some in Omau and everything. You know, all the rivers, the reservoirs, the water will go through there. And I know they mentioned something about arsenic in there. and whoever did the environmental assessment said everything was cool. We know through experience that engineering sometimes messes up. And if it does mess up, it messes up the entire water system in Kualoa, as well as down in Hanakaapi where it gets out into the ocean. So is Green Energy doing testing on the water that goes back into the stream after you
Yes. It? Yeah, the answer is yes. We, in our original EA, we assumed, and we have in our FONSI, in our permitting, our use and special use permit, et cetera, we've got a right to pull from the Malka Reservoir and return it to the ditch system that goes straight back to the reservoir. But in our final EA that we did at the NEPA level, the national level, we actually closed it up to a tighter footprint where we're pulling from our own well system on the land and returning it through percolation to the same aquifer. And that, for us, as environmentally conscious individuals here leading this, we thought, well, excellent, because then it's right there, tied to the same aquifer, pulling up, pulling down, and because of the closed loop system where you're just cooling, you don't have a treatment, you don't have a poisoning of the water, that it removes the return of the water to the Malka Reservoir directly, and so it's being percolated through the
so
land.
It's not going into the rivers.
No. Originally, you're right. It was back in 2007, our original concept, but we improved that based on the feedback we got.
That's great news.
It's one of the really improvements that we're enjoying together collectively to find the best solution.
Well, that's just a really great example of how when a project is open and listening to the community that you can benefit, and the project will become improved from that. So often, people, I don't know if they're not confident enough that they're willing to listen, not confident enough that their idea can be improved. So I want to congratulate you for that. That's awesome.
So a caller just called in real quick, and they're asking, why don't you just use solar power? But if you had listened to our last show, we had covered a large portion of it about the solar power, and if anyone wants to sum that up in real quick.
I can if you'd like. I mean, we do need solar, PV, to a certain degree in our portfolio. We know that you only have intermittent production of 24 to 26% of the time production. So behind that, you have to have often, here on Kauai, fossil fuel production, which is firm. So when that's not, when the sun's not shining in the evenings, morning, nighttime, strong enough to produce that electricity, you've got to have production behind it. So you've got capital capacity you've got to have, which is very expensive, and it requires us to be dependent on that fossil fuel production or some other firm production like hydro or biomass. So yes, you want photovoltaic to a certain degree in your portfolio, but you can't be completely intermittent, otherwise we'll only have production during the 10 to 2 time period, and on the shoulders lesser degree, less production during the day. So we've got to have firm power production, which on Kauai, the only two options right now that are practical are hydro and biomass, if you're not going to go for oil and naphtha.
And we did discuss last week how there is some basically battery elements that can happen, but that's a big waste. It's a big waste, so that you know.
Well, and that doesn't replace firmness. What that does, it just helps smooth out the transitions.
Yeah.
So, but I do want to say also that you know, KIEC is looking at hydro, and they've got some very large PV projects coming on board in the next couple of years. And so, I really think that KIEC should be commended for that. I think that KIEC will be one of the leading grids in the country. As far as having a penetration of PV onto the grid. So that's exciting. So I think that KIEC is doing a lot of things well, and I think they could do some things better.
Agreed. I agree with that as well. And although PV is good, I think we do need a broad portfolio of a lot of different sources of energy. And PV is during the day, but that's when our peak is as well. There's not as many people up at night, so we don't need as much power. So the more PV we have, the less sustainable, you know, round-the-clock type power we need to be generating, because what we want to do is get away from those diesel generators burning the fossil fuel and get to stuff that we grow here locally on Kauai and that we generate here.
I think if we introduce some hydro too, though, again, anytime we create energy, we're having environmental impact, and so it's tough to even want to talk about hydro, but hydro, usually when it's raining hard, the sun isn't shining. Also, it tends to rain more at night. So that also can be a good offset on the power production.
And there are some companies working over on the west side with the ag development people over there to put in some hydro on that water that's coming anyway to irrigate the fields and just get extra use out of that water before it gets to its destination to irrigate the agriculture.
Again, that's a stacked function, a win-win when it is
exactly.
being managed in that way.
Right, but I think that the point that Eric made earlier in the show about the demand side, hey, you know, we can try and make all the power we want to in the world, but if you have some kind of beautiful clean energy source and you've got your windows open and the air conditioning on, that doesn't make any sense, you know. So what we really need to look at, and I know this is counterintuitive for everybody, but it's not so much the creating the power that we need, it's not using the power that we don't need to, it's the demand side, it's the using. And so if we can all just remember every time we talk about how great hydro might be, to talk about how great savings might be, because it's reducing the power that we use is going to be the true solution. It's, you have supply and you have demand, and they always have to equal each other. And if your supply is not high enough, maybe you should focus on reducing your demand, because that's going to get you down to where you need to be.
That's a great response. Another call had a quick question on, they're wondering why the return address on their KIUC bill was going to Oahu, because it's a KIUC, yet their bill is going to Oahu, and they were just a little confused about that. Are we independent, or are we connected on a state level? If one of you would like to answer that.
Do you know the answer to that, Eric? You had your hand up. Oh.
Waving to a colleague.
Oh. I would love to know the answer to that question, and I do not know the answer. I think that KIUC, one of the priorities for KIUC as an organization should be to stop hemorrhaging capital out of our island, out of our local economy. And that's why, you know, the biomass project is so exciting to me, because it's keeping our energy dollars here on island. But one really simple way that KIUC might be able to keep more of our energy dollars on island would be not to have people mail their checks to KIUC to Oahu.
Well, that would, to me, I would think that probably they have an outside accounting firm dealing with the billing. Though I do pay my bill on direct payment, so it stops that.
And I use direct payment, too, so I don't know where it goes. But I do have my bill in my car, so I'll go out there and look after this and see where it's supposed to be mailed to.
Yeah, that might be a small but symbolic action that KIUC could take to demonstrate its commitment to keeping our energy dollars on island.
Right, and if we're paying people to be answering the billing issues on island here as opposed to doing it
yeah,
on
well, then
Oahu.
Those are creating more jobs here on Kauai, and that's good for our local community.
Someone just told me that there was a notice online to pay their bills online instead of sending it to Honolulu, and that was a notice from KIUC. So maybe it's better if people are paying their bills online instead of sending their bills to Oahu. So, yeah.
Online costs you $4.75 to make that payment. You send it by envelope, and it costs you 44 cents.
Though it's if you just do it on direct payment, then there is no...
PayPal takes that.
There isn't when you do a direct payment. But the thing is then that it's easier for people who are really solid on their bank account right. to have that happen. If you do... an automatic withdrawal and
yeah, you need sufficient funds.
You need sufficient funds, otherwise, yeah. then you're going to really run into an issue. And not and bills can be really quite expensive. And like we're talking about the fluctuations, that can be a challenge. Coming up next is Jazz with John. You're listening to KIUC, KKCR, and we are talking about. This is Kauai Community Radio. We are talking about Kauai Island Utility Cooperative, and we have some great people in the studio here. We have one more caller.
So, quick question. A caller just called in, and they did not know what a smart meter was, and they had heard stuff was bad about a smart meter. And if someone wants to briefly answer and summarize that answer, and, you know, we have about 12 minutes left, so...
I could take a stab at that. A smart meter is an enhanced meter that allows the utility to better measure how much electricity you're using. And what makes it smart is that it can deliver that information in real time. So it can tell the utility if you're using power at 5 o'clock in the morning or at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, there's a whole bunch of different ways that you can have a smart meter. You can have wired smart meters, which means is that like a modem almost like that, like the old school wired modem. And that would give the information to the utility about your electrical use. Or you could have wireless smart meters, and wireless smart meters using a Wi-Fi like broadcasting. That's the kind of smart meter that KIC has chosen to go with. Now, some people have great concerns about all of our deep affection for wireless communication. Some people are sensitive to it, and it's very unhealthy for them. And so that creates an issue about smart meters.
I want to add something on that. Like, I lived in solar houses, and I'm used to being power self-sufficient. And so I get really attached to being able to go to bed in that zero energy field. Now, I don't have that in my house that is right on the grid. But I don't have a smart meter, and I'm happy that I don't have a smart meter. And I just did go around with some folks, and we're, you know, measuring the field, and there is a field. Now, whether that's worse than another, you know, that's up for debate, you know, or maybe it's bad for some people, not for others. But definitely, without question, it is emitting a field all the way down the street. So sometimes I think, how is that saving us energy? To me, that's like line loss when we have this power field that's everywhere.
Well, it's a bunch of devices, 26,000 more devices that are on all the time on the grid. And, you know, that there's a cost to that. Now, the question is, does the benefit to it outweigh the cost? Well, I don't know.
Well, I don't know either. I think I liked what you had to say earlier when you have the meter going inside. When you've got something on your dashboard, that makes a real difference.
Well, that's empowering the user of electricity. Because, I mean, can you imagine if you didn't have a speedometer or odometer inside your car?
Or a gas gauge.
Or a gas gauge. You'd be driving around the island, you'd like, boom, oh, I ran out of gas again. Oh, I had no idea how much I had in the tank. And the cop pulls you over and says, how fast you go? And you say, no. No, I have no idea how fast that
was. Or if it was always being filled, you would not have a sense of how to conserve. If every morning you got up and you had a full tank of gas and then you paid for it at the end of the month. I got this little notice in the mail today about a Verizon wireless 4G, no, AT&T. AT&T putting a 4G pole right near my house. I'm like, ah. I'm not excited about that. I think the thing is that, like, if I have wireless internet in my house or if I have a cell phone in my pocket, I'm choosing it. This AT&T power pole, I mean cellular transmitter, I'm actually kind of really bummed to see that right there. I think what we have to think about is when we have convergence of all these things, if we have little tiny pieces of radiation coming through our food and the fish that, you know, are swimming in waters that's flushed out of Fukushima. We're eating GMO foods. We've got the cell phone towers near us. We've got the solar things. You know, who knows what? You know I'm turning into a little bit of a space cadet. I'm trying not to. I think, at my age, should I be hitting that point so early? I don't know, you know. And so something is affecting us. And the thing that's really tough is that almost all of these contaminants that are in our environment, they have these same nebulous effects out. And I think, so I'm going to ask both of you, because this is actually something really important to me. Do you believe that, your loaded question here, but smart meters should be voluntary or... You know, it felt thug-like what was going on last year in forcing everybody to have them. We had to put up a really big fight to get the respect to not have them.
Right, and I think right now you don't have to have them.
You don't, because we put up a big fight.
And I think that's the right way to go. I think it should be voluntary for people. I mean, they do have some advantage, particularly in the demand side management. You can know a lot more about how you're using with a smart meter.
But not with a meter going only to the power company. It doesn't show inside the house. You don't see. You don't see. They'd see. We don't see. You know, the user doesn't see with that.
But there's things you can see just going and looking at your smart meter on the outside of your house that you couldn't if you have the regular meter. I mean, the smart meter cycles through different readings as you look at the face of the meter, and you can see what your peak usage was, which you never could see with your other meter, as well as your continuous, you know, whether it's spinning fast right now or slow right now.
But if it was in there right where you're brushing your teeth or something like that, you would be able to see what's going on. If it's in, if it's on your dashboard, I think that, that that's a better one. And then I do know for the people who are highly sensitive to this stuff.
Yeah, that's an issue.
That's an issue.
That's a real issue. And it's not easily resolved either because, you know, let's say we all have our free will or free choice if we want a smart meter or not. Some people do, some people don't. Okay, fine. Well, then you have folks who are electrosensitive, and then they feel like they're trapped inside their homes. They feel like they can't go downtown. They can't go shopping. They can't go to stores because they're surrounded by all these fields of electromagnetic radiation and electromagnetic energy. And it doesn't feel healthy to them. So, you know, that's like maybe it's akin to smoking, how smoking used to be in restaurants
right.
30 years ago.
Right, I would say that's not the way it is.
You know, oh, excuse me, sir, your secondhand smoke is bothering me. People were laughed away for decades about that until finally the data was able to show, well, you know, here we are in this brave new wireless world where honestly we don't really know what the cumulative results of all of this experimentation that we're doing, and we may come to find out 10, 20 years from now when the science actually catches up, gosh, we made a little bit of a mistake. I don't know where we stand with that.
I suppose what I would like to see, I'm just getting to push my own agenda here for a moment, is more asking. I know for me that it really makes a very big difference if somebody gives me the balance and says, can you live with this or can you not? And that's why, like, I make an extra effort to have people from the Hawaiian community be in here when we're talking about energy, because we need to hear from all of these different sectors. It's almost time to go. We will be having county council report before we end, so I want to go around the room and just give you each a moment to give a last thought, and we won't be taking any more calls because we are POW. Sherry?
I just wanted to thank everybody who participated in the call-in session, and I just want to make sure that with the utmost clarity that I am on the wait list too. I live on Hawaiian homelands, and I benefit from it by living with my mom. I am renting currently a home on another piece of property, but I just wanted to say that I too am affected by all the decisions that the administration makes, which for us, you know, it is not pono. And I hope, Felicia, you would allow us to come into this room once again.
Oh,
and
certainly.
And provide an opportunity to engage with the community, but to let us tell you our point of view and where we stand, and to know that when we sit in Department of Hawaiian Home meetings, we are not sitting alongside, but we are on the opposite side of the table advocating for what many people out there are, you know, in question of the motives that we do and how we choose the things we choose.
Sounds,
so with that, aloha.
Sounds great. I'd love to have a show focused on that. Eric?
Just appreciation to each of you. Everyone in this room has an ambition to improve what we have today, now, and within our lifetimes. And so thank you, each of you.
Yeah,
Jonathan?
I just really want to echo that. It's quite an education to sit here and listen to what Sherry and Teddy were saying earlier. And so I feel really informed by that. And I just want to stop talking right now so that more people can get their words in.
I just want to thank you for having us here. And touch on one thing you said, you know, that you know that the people outside the public is becoming more empowered. PLDC, GMO, the Water Commission now, and I think that's a great thing. Hawaiian Homes, and when people start to take notice, the politicians take notice too, and they soon will be more deliberate in their actions. I guarantee that.
And last but not least, I want to thank everybody as well for this opportunity. And I would just leave with a note that although Jonathan and myself might have different backgrounds, one thing we do have in common is we would both be new faces to the KAOC board. And I think a lot of times new people coming in and looking at things through new eyes helps with moving change along a little faster and getting us where we all want to go. And so if you're willing to vote for me, I would appreciate your vote.
Jack Benzie.
And just a closing statement from Eric Cannon. I just want to say, hey, thank you to all of our guests today. You guys are all awesome intellectual speakers, and we really appreciate you coming to the show. But a big mahalo to all the callers that came in and put in some great questions. And this show is for you guys out there. That's why we're all here, for you. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Kauai Soapbox Live. Jazz with John is up. This is KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea.